All right. Well, JP, thank you so much for joining me. I hope you're doing well. Tell me, first of all, what's life been like during this season hiatus?
It's kind of boring, Adam, to be honest, because I'm one of those people that I just love to work. I love the games. I love people that I am in touch with. Love the fans, obviously, of Philadelphia and in these other cities that I got to travel to. So, you know, I definitely miss MLS, but this pandemic is obviously much bigger than sports. It's a sad time. I'm hoping that people are doing the right thing. Being smart, I think, leads to being well and to being safe. You know, the 6 foot distance, you know, minimizing contact as best you can. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, we'll get through this. I think it's important to try to stay busy. So I do a couple of walks in a day, ride the exercise bike. I'm probably the fittest I've ever been, not by choice. Doing charts of other MLS teams in the hope and expectation that at some point in the near future, MLS will be back, and I want to be ready for it because I think that, you know, whenever we do get started, the games are going to come fast and furious, whether we play a full schedule or whether it's condensed. I see a lot of 2 games a week and 3 games in 8 nights happening more often than in the past.
All right. So JP, let me ask you this then. You talked about preparation, and I know you're one of the more prepared guys day in and day out, but also you've had a lot of experience figuring out how to get prepared, what it means to be prepared when you feel like you are actually at the point where you are prepared. And we're talking on the day of the first game in MLS history. So I want you to sort of take me back and tell me about personally what it was like for you, what you remember around that time, what was happening in American soccer, the vibe like in soccer when this league was getting off the ground, and how did you be a part of that?
Well, I can remember back to that first game, and I was watching it on television as Phil Shane and Ty Keogh, if I remember correctly, were the announcers for that game, and I saw Wijnaldum's goal, and I saw the passion in the stands, and it was sort of like a dream come true for me because for the longest time, and when I was working in television, indoor soccer was the game of the week. The old MISL was all we had, right? There was no, you couldn't watch really games on a regular basis from England, Germany, Spain, Italy, like we are spoiled by now. We didn't have that. We didn't have a pro league in this country. I mean, we had some that were maybe semi-pro or on a lower level, but nothing like what MLS is today. And I can remember the optimism. Going back to 1990 World Cup, I can remember the optimism where people knew that MLS was coming, that was part of the deal with FIFA. You know, a new pro league would be coming. I remember being at the unveiling in New York City when a lot of these players were introduced. The colors, as I remember, were introduced. The names. And remember, Adam, those goofy names?
Yes.
Really? Yes. The Dallas Burn? No. San Jose Clash? No. And the all-time worst for me, no disrespect to whoever came up with it, you know what it is, right? Kansas City Whiz.
I was going to say the Whiz.
Whiz means something totally different, my friends. That's the worst name of all time. Maybe in sports history, not just soccer. That was terrible. So I think we've come a long way from goofy names, you know, crazy colors, huge stadiums. I mean, we had 100,000 seat stadiums that were not even half empty. Half empty would have been great. More than three quarters empty. Football lines, we have come such a long way where now, you know, the names are better, the logos are better, except for everybody wanting to use United. The stadiums are better. You know, back then, Adam, we had no training facilities on our own. Like, nobody had their own training facility, right? And if you look at some of these stadiums, whether it was the Rose Bowl, the Cotton Bowl, the old Giants Stadium, right? There were football teams there, so we had those god-awful football lines while we're trying to broadcast games. And I remember doing games at the old Giants Stadium where I was thinking to myself, you know, why did that guy go for that ball? And I realized the ball was out, but there were so many lines in that sideline that I couldn't tell, you know, in the heat of the moment where the sideline came to an end.
And you think about fans trying to take that in too, and also, you know, when they're not as familiar with the game, you don't – it's not on TV like now. You can go find as many highlights as you want. You could understand from little YouTube videos. Back then, you were also the sort of the primary source of information for a lot of about soccer.
Yeah, our fans are very, very educated in the United States. Don't let anyone convince you otherwise. Very educated. And part of that, I think, comes from being able to watch all of these other leagues and being able to watch our own league up close and personal. You know, we're talking about 10 teams that started in MLS, and not all of them are with us today. We're going to have 30 teams within a couple of years in MLS, right? We span not only in the U.S., but now also in Canada, and maybe one day we'll be in Mexico too. So it has grown beyond leaps and bounds. It is amazing how far we've come. But now I don't think we need maybe the gimmicks that we had, you know, back in those days. I think we can rely now on the soccer. And to me, one of the biggest differences, I'll give you two that I think have changed, three that have changed MLS since 1996. One is the new stadiums, right, that everyone has, pretty much everyone has, right? So, you know, we've gone from stadiums that were too big to fill to, for the most part, you know, stadiums that are in the 20 to 25,000 seat range that we can fill. That's one. Two is the training facilities. I've seen personally Atlantis. I've seen LAFCs. They're as good as any training facility, not in this country. How about in the world? And that's not just my opinion. That's from people that have come over from various foreign countries who have seen that and have been totally impressed with that. And then the third thing for me, supporters, traveling supporters. We may have had them in 96. I don't have any recollection of them, but I can tell you this from a broadcast standpoint, they make all of these MLS games that much more exciting. And when you think of maybe a closer rival to the Union, when the team is playing, let's say, Red Bulls or NYCFC or DC United, you have a lot more supporters there. I mean, I've seen maybe 100 people there from Seattle come in sometimes to watch the Union play. But I think that same thing, when the Union go to DC, when the Union go to Red Bull Arena, our fans make that stadium rock, because when you have visiting supporters that are that loud, they make the home crowd that much louder because they don't want to be outdone by the visitors.
I remember this from the Union Red Bull playoff game last year, where when the Union kept going down by two goals, the Red Bull support there, you know, they got so vocal. And then the Union supporters actually came back, and Jim Curtin talked about it after the game. And you could say, with some choice words for the players, urged them forward. And that's almost in response to what you're hearing from the away fans. But what I'm hearing from you really is, like, all this about atmosphere and about, I think it's sort of the thing that sets soccer apart on the world stage as well, is that you have all these traditions that develop in concert with the team from the supporters. So I'm curious, when you think back, how did that develop? Do you remember any sort of trajectory? Is there like a game you look back on and go, I'm never going to forget that atmosphere and how it felt to me? Or not a game, but sort of like a progression from the beginning to now, and how it's become something so special.
Adam, it would be a great trivia question, and maybe somebody knows this out there. You know, who was the first MLS supporters club, you know, back in 96 or whenever they first started them? But they've certainly come a long way, right? I mean, Sons of Ben became a name before the Union ever played a game. I mean, they were helpful in getting Philadelphia the franchise in the first place. So, I mean, supporters clubs have come a long way when you think about it, not even just, you know, coming out to the games, but what they do in their own communities, you know, charitable contributions that they make, the way they bond with the players, the support they give the clubs. It has been fantastic to watch the overall growth. And I think that, you know, from a national standpoint, I can remember, I think Sam's Army might have been the first one that I can think of. Maybe there was one before that. But now the American Outlaws have taken it to a totally new level. And, you know, when I was broadcasting games for the U.S. men's team, we didn't have those crowds there. I mean, I did a game in 1989 in Trinidad where there were two rows of U.S. And I'm not even going to say supporters. They were working for U.S. soccer. So it wasn't even, you know, two rows of fans in that stadium. It was two rows of people that probably had to be there, you know, wanted to be there, but also had to be there. And now, you know, you could go to any game. I remember U.S. played Cuba, and it was a ban going on, right? You're not supposed to go to Cuba. And we had some American outlaws that were there. So, you know, they find ways to do it. They find ways to support their team. And I think they are there through thick and thin. And can't say enough about what the supporters have done for each club in this league and for this league in general.
It's funny because, you know, it's that quintessential American thing where if we're going to do it, we're going to do it as big and bold as we possibly can. So every year, you know, it grows and grows. And you see some of these TIFOs out there now.
I was just going to say that, traditions. The TIFOs, right? Yeah, we want to be the best. Those TIFOs are amazing in various places, and sometimes they're topical, sometimes they're funny, sometimes they're trendy, sometimes it's all of those. But the amount of work that they put into that, right? And that's like a volunteer thing, right? Nobody's getting paid to put those things out there. And you always see players talking about them too, how they saw that or a coach saw that. And, you know, sometimes on television, they will point that out. You know, the tributes that we have seen with TIFOs have come a long, long way from when they first started.
So take me back personally, where you in your career, what was going on when MLS began and sort of, you know, it is a touch point now for American soccer, establishing that league, making sure that it remained relevant and had space to grow. You know, there were some really touch and go moments in MLS's history now that we can look back on. So where were you personally? How did you get involved? And then how did you continue involved over the years to this point where you are the voice of the Philadelphia Union?
Well, I was probably at that time, Adam, trying to think back. So indoor was done for me then. I was doing outdoor games, whether it was U.S. men or U.S. women. And then when 96 came around, I don't remember how I first got connected with the Columbus Crew, but they made a call to me and to Ty Keel, and we were their original voices. We did not do home games, so I never got to see the Shoe, right? I never got to see Ohio State's stadium. Just road games is what we did, and they had a very sluggish start, I remember. But they did well at the end of the season. Brad Friedel came in. They changed coaches. The late Tom Fitzgerald took over, and they made it to the playoffs. Janusz Michalek, a good friend of mine, former U.S. national team player, was also a member of that team. Brian McBride was on that team. I mean, they had a good club back then, just a slow start because everybody was brand new to it, right? And when you think back to 96, scouting was not like it is today.
Yeah.
You know, video, not like it is today. The monitors, the GPS monitors that players wear today, I don't even know if they were invented then, but if they were, we certainly didn't have them. So it has come a long way. And I started off with the Crew, and it was great, you know, to work with them. I think also at that time, one of the women's leagues, WUSA, was getting started. Left the Crew, and it was so long ago that I don't remember whether I left to go to the Metro Stars or whether it was back with ESPN, but I ended up with the Metro Stars. That was my next gig, and I did Metro Stars and Red Bulls for several years. Took a job in Atlanta with the Atlanta Thrashers, and then ESPN came calling again. I think I had worked with them. That was my third time. And when I went to work with ESPN, I was in the last year of a three-year deal. Philadelphia Union was starting up, and I thought, this is going to be a great job for somebody. And I thought, you know, if my contract comes to an end, and at that time ESPN was leaning towards the European voices like they did for the World Cup, I thought I could be on the outside looking in. I really want that Philadelphia job. And so I talked to, at the time, Nick Sakevich, who was there, and I had to have everything cleared, though, with ESPN.
Okay.
And when I went back to them, the only thing that saved me, because they wouldn't let me do anything really because of contractual obligations, but I said to them, listen, I said, it's a Disney affiliate. It's 6ABC that's doing the games, even though back then I think 6ABC may have done like 3 or 4. But I sold them on the 6ABC, and they went with it, and then the rest is history. I didn't get my contract renewed after that, but I started my first of what was going to be 10 years with the Union, and this would have been, and still will be, the 11th.
Okay, so JP, that is quite a journey, but I want to go back to when you were talking about working with Columbus, because that, if I'm not incorrect, is where the first soccer-specific stadium was built. Can you tell me anything about your memories of that? Because that, now we look back on it, it's a major turning point.
Yeah, I love that stadium, first of all. Atmosphere was always great there. Our press box was pretty low, so you could see everything that was happening out on the field. I think that in the end, fans grew a little bit weary, not because they were on the outskirts of town or it was difficult to get to or anything like that, but I think they saw all these other stadiums that were popping up and state-of-the-art facilities, and why not them? So I think that became an issue more in Columbus than anywhere else. And back in those days, everyone said MLS is a family sport, got to be in the suburbs, and that's why the Chicago Fire ended up where they were, and other teams, right, as well. But now when you look at MLS, what are they saying? The key word is downtown stadium, got to have it. So everything has changed, but that's to be expected, right, in a fast-changing world. At some point, the demographics do change. At one point, we're saying, let's get all of these families in the suburbs to come to the games. And then somebody else is saying, what about the people that work in the city that have access to public transportation? You want to get the person that's coming right out of work, to come to the game. You want to have those supporters that want to get together at a pub before the game and want to tailgate. And it's easier to do that when you're downtown.
So that actually brings up a great point for me, because the thing I'm always curious about is, if you're around the game back in 96 when this was going on, you got the World Cup, huge success, but still launching a league is going to be such a risky proposition. And for someone like you who is sort of around this when it's happening, how did it feel? Did you feel like American soccer was ready for this? Did you feel like wow, we're just going to flip a coin and go for this?
Yeah, I'm always optimistic, Adam, always optimistic. So I knew in my own mind that MLS would be a success. To what degree, I didn't know. But I'll be honest with you, I never would have expected 25 years after that we would be looking at maybe getting into 30 markets in two countries, playing in other competitions. I think anybody that could sit back then, even the best visionaries we have, if somebody could have looked back in 1996 and been able to have said, we will at one point have 30 teams, we'll have major networks televising all of our games, we'll be bringing in all these foreign clubs to play here, we'll have great supporters clubs, we'll have our own stadiums, we'll have our own training facilities, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That person's not telling you the truth, because no one could have predicted, this kind of success. We're getting players transfers for $15 million from other countries. Yep. The game changer for me, the game changer of it all, was David Beckham coming here. No one in 1996 could have said, could we get at some point the biggest star, not the best player, but the biggest star, which Beckham was, in the world, that we could get him here one day, and it would be in his prime. Maybe 2 years later than you wanted, but still, he had some very great years here. And I think when they write the book on MLS someday down the road, at least one chapter has to be devoted to David Beckham, because if he doesn't come here, I don't think the others come either. They would not have been the first. You needed a first guy, and Beckham was it.
So what's your memory of his arrival? Was it sort of, I know it shook the soccer world, but he's still someone where you then need to find a way to capitalize on it. A guy who doesn't actually score that many goals, his most spectacular thing he does is free kicks. It's sort of like you still have this risk there where you don't really understand how to capitalize on it, except for the fact that, admittedly he's a good-looking guy.
There's no way to measure this, statistically, I don't think, but I said this at the time, that the day before he signed and the day he signed and the day after he signed, MLS drew more media attention around the world than all of their previous years combined. It was not just on the sports page in the US, not on the sports page in all of the world's newspapers. It was front page news in many places. And I remember a couple of days before, I sent an email to somebody and I said, do you believe the stuff about Beckham? Because it was rumor, right? It was not, you know, he's definitely coming, rumor. And my friend wrote back to me and said, in some cases, you can believe what you're hearing. So I kind of knew maybe 24 hours before that that was going to happen. You know, until then, I was hopeful. I was optimistic, but I didn't know it would happen for sure. And he more than delivered on that. And not only did he bring all these other players here, but all these other franchises, including the one he now is in charge of in Miami.
So let me ask you this, because I think it relates to Beckham. You know, originally when the league formed, you had these special rules like the penalty kicks and you know, you ran up like almost like it was a hockey penalty. There were these ways that they tried to make the game sort of Americanize it in a way that would fit the American audience. And over time, I think Beckham is a part of this. It's moved to sort of where the instead Americans have adopted some of these European and the South American traditions and you know, put their own twist on it, but adopted them all the same. Is that sort of how you've seen it develop, that from going a you know, very American version to something now where Americans go, no, this is soccer as the world sees it, but it's our version of it?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we do some things different than the rest of the world. You know, we have playoffs. We don't have promotion relegation. But our game is very similar to the rest of the world. And I think that's a plus. I mean, hey, you start something out in this country. Remember how the media was back then. Media was very skeptical. I mean, sports writers didn't want to cover soccer. Part of that was because they, I don't want to say they hated it. If you never watched something, how could you hate it? You know what I mean? But they would say they hated it. It was really maybe more because they didn't know it and didn't want to be exposed on it. And, you know, would rather talk about baseball, football, basketball, hockey, you know, whatever they wanted to talk about, right? So I think that I don't blame MLS for doing things in those early days like that shootout. You know, it was exciting, right? They ran the clock, remember, from 45 down, right? Instead of 0 to 45. You know, things like that, because they were trying. So I don't fault them for trying. But those were gimmicks, right? And as I said earlier in this discussion, you know, we're not a gimmicky league anymore. You know, we do things creatively. We do have some gimmicks, but it's mostly in probably mascots or cheerleaders or people in the stadiums like a Timber Joey in Portland or Fang in Philly. You know, there's different things like that, how we Americanize the game. Maybe we do things more with cheerleaders and with mascots than they do overseas. But for the most part, you know, it's the same game. And I do think also, you know, for all those that talk about promotion relegation, don't see it happening in our lifetime for a lot of reasons. You know, you're asking people to invest a ton of money, you know, $300 million right now, to go possibly into the second division a year later. It's not going to fly in this country. And I'll make another wager with you. If you asked people in England, in the EPL, what they think of promotion, relegation, put them on a lie detector and ask them if they would rather have that or playoffs like we have, and you might be surprised at the answer, because there are some teams, you know, when I was growing up and calling games for ESPN International, one of the better teams was Leeds. Where's Leeds right now? When they were dumped, relegated from the EPL, when have they come back? You know how much money that is? A club like that that used to be a successful club and now on the outside looking in. So I think that in the ideal world, push comes to shove. I mean, it is what it is there. That's what they grew up with. But if you ask those guys behind closed doors, would they rather have no promotion relegation and do playoffs or something like we do, you might be surprised at their answer.
It's funny because, you know, you bring up the playoffs, and I do feel like that's one of the things that America has that is a, you know, a pretty enticing export to other leagues. Whereas I think one of the last sort of gimmicky things that's slowly falling by the wayside is the super draft, where you pull people out of college. And that's because the academy system is up and running. And so the thing I want to talk with you about is the effect that MLS has had on the American player over time. Because you look at the academy system now, it's driving a lot of the growth of the sport and a lot of the young talents start in the academy and then get picked off by some of the bigger European clubs like Bayern Munich has been very active. Yeah. Borussia Dortmund, we see Gio Reyna right now. So can you talk to me about sort of how you've seen that from a macro perspective develop, where these guys now get when they're 15 and you see them in some academy games or maybe a cup game and then develop?
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned the academies, because I had a cheat sheet that because I'm trying to look at this camera, I'm not able to look at my cheat sheet, but I know academies was on there as one of the points that I wanted to talk about, because that's something that obviously we didn't have in 1996. And I think that I like college soccer, men's and women's, but I'm one of those that does not believe that the men's college soccer is doing what they are capable of doing, because too many games in too short a time. I like the thought that they're proposing where they split the season, you know, play the College Cup in the spring, you know, have more games, but spread them out. I think it would help them. And I also don't like the substitution rule, because I don't think it helps you become a professional player. Having said that, I understand that not all of these college players are going to be playing professionally. So that's not their job. But the job for the academy, I think, is different, right? Because people that are in these academies, these young players that are 14, 15, 16, that is their goal. That's what they want to do. They're not thinking about being a doctor, lawyer, teacher when they come out of that academy. They're thinking about being a soccer player, right? So I think that if the colleges want to keep up with the academies in terms of being able to supply players to the pros, I think they have to look at that split season and do a better job of that. I think they have to do the three substitution rule like we have in the pros. And I think that would help too. Those are just, you know, thoughts that I have. The college game, though, can be very exciting. And at the highest levels with some of the teams that play attractive soccer, it's fantastic to watch. But I'd like to see the colleges be able to do better in terms of producing those players directly from the colleges right on to an MLS team. But I think the academies have been the way to go now for the last few years anyway. I think that the union are in the forefront in terms of developing these players, and more so than developing these players, Adam, but giving them a chance to play. You know, John Hackworth before, Jim Curtin now, they trust these kids, right? And the only way you can show you trust a kid is to play him. And play him in games that count, right? Austin Trusty, who's no longer with the team, but he was one of those players. You know, Mark McKenzie, you know, Brendan Aronson. The list goes on and on about young players, Anthony Fontana. So many other names of players that are coming from the academy and getting time in the field. And I think the only other team that we could put in the same conversation with the union is probably like an FC Dallas, who really believe in this as well, whether it was Oscar Perea before that or Luchi Gonzalez now, you know, kids like Pomacall, Ferreira, and others, you know, they give these kids a chance to play. So I think academies, you know, with the other improvements that I was talking about earlier that MLS has made, academies are like the next step to developing the next great American players. And I think we have to develop more, way more, for a couple of reasons. One, more teams are coming in, right? So you're spreading the talent thinner, right? And then the other thing is we're losing players. Alfonso Davies could have been a star in this league for years, right? He's already gone. And there'll be other players that will go from our academies overseas, some without playing a single game in Major League Soccer. So I think the focus has to be more on those academies, and I think more teams will let some of these young kids play, because it is the only way they're going to get better. If you look at some of the players that have gone overseas, they've gotten worse because they haven't played. It's great to go to England. It's great to go to Germany. And if you're one of the lucky ones, like Christian Pulisic, and by lucky, I mean he's talented, but if he went somewhere else, maybe he doesn't play, right? But Dortmund has had a history of playing young players. So if you go over there and you play our American kids, Tyler Adams, Weston McKinney, those guys will shine. Gio Reyna, future star. It'll happen, right? But if you lose guys like Gio Reyna, he's not going to play in MLS, you know, we need to develop more players that will be staying here that can help us grow our league.
So, JP, let me end by asking you this question then. So I think, you know, we've covered how MLS started and how it sort of evolved to this place where, you know, you have these young Americans pushing for time and you have some getting picked off so early because they are that good. A lot of people will say that the sort of transitional moment for MLS is when an MLS team can win CONCACAF Champions League, show that they can really go blow to blow with Liga MX. What do you see as the next plateau that MLS has to reach? What is the next step? Is it just getting these academy guys into the team regularly, having more coaches that trust them? What's next that we should look for?
Wow. CONCACAF Champions League is tough for me, Adam, because we have never, even going into this year, we have never been set up properly to win this. I think our teams are as good as Mexican teams. You know, on a given day, our teams are better. On a given day, their teams are better. But we have never played Mexican teams in the CONCACAF Champions League where we're at an even playing level. That's why, you know, maybe in the League's Cup, there was a better opportunity for that with players more in form and in season. I think right. CONCACAF Champions League is, I don't want to say it's a waste of time or a waste of energy, but when I see us playing in very small countries where they have no chance really of winning, where the fields are not good and somewhat dangerous to players, where the lighting is not good for television, you know, I'd rather see the U.S. play Mexico. I think League's Cup is the way to go. Sorry, CONCACAF, but I forget about CONCACAF Champions League. Let that be for the other nations. U.S.-Mexico is a fantastic rivalry, and I think we should build on that. And that's the way we get better, playing games against Mexican teams, not playing against teams from some of the smaller countries in CONCACAF. I respect, you know, their decision that they want to get better by playing against some of the better teams. But, you know, if you're asking me how we get better, I think it's to play Mexican teams, and the better the Mexican teams, the better the competition. But we need to play whatever the competition is in our season, right? If we ever play, some have said we should play Copa Libertadores, some have said right. We should, you know, make up our own thing. I'm okay with any of those competitions as long as it's a level playing field. You know, if you have LAFC and Bob Bradley's leading the way, or you have Atlanta United with Joseph Martinez healthy, I trust those teams against whoever, you know, in any situation. As long as, you know, both teams are at the same point in their season, and on some days, LAFC will win or Atlanta United will win against a better opponent from another country, and other days they lose. But I'd take my chances if the playing field is level.
All right. JP, thank you so much for talking to me as we celebrate the kickoff of MLS back in 1996. You've been such a big part of American soccer for the entire tenure of the league. So thank you for taking some time to chat.
Adam, it's my pleasure. And if we gave somebody, I don't know how much time this was, but if we gave somebody 20 minutes to forget about the problems that we are having in our country, I think that's a great way to spend 20 minutes. Before closing, though, I do want to thank our doctors, our nurses, our military, our volunteers for all of the help in trying to battle this virus. They're on the front lines every day, you know, working for us. And I hope our union fans, our supporters, our players, our coaches are respecting the 6-foot distance, are being smart, and are being safe. And I hope to see everybody very soon in the old normal on the field.
Great. Thank you, JP. I'll talk to you soon.
My pleasure.